Welcome to Skills Journey, hosted by Emil Rovenheimer and Yanni Brofenboer from PopUp, the People Upliftment Program. This is your passport to a transformative journey where we uncover the power of skills together.
Welcome back to Skills Journey. We are privileged to have Leona Pienaar in the studio with us, and we are continuing the conversation. So if you missed our first chat, please catch up on that on the podcast. But we are going to dive even deeper into her skills journey. And Leona, it's such a privilege to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's our absolute pleasure. We've been talking about kind of your early days at MES and the work that you've done and how you kind of found yourself to integrate into the community of Hillbrow and how that kind of shaped your reality. But we'd really want to kind of just go back a little bit to the early years when you were studying at Stellenbosch and what you studied and how that kind of changed your approach as you started on this journey that, you know, looking back 20 years later, you just recognize the immense change that's happened in the way that you think about skills.
Yeah, I think in those days when we studied social work, we did a lot of practical placements. So just to mention a few, so I worked in Paulsmoor Prison, and the assignment was group work with rapists, and I was locked in a cell, and I had to navigate these eight men as a student, a third-year student. And looking back, I think it was actually crazy that they would let us do this stuff, but we did. And then I worked in oncology with children who were ill and were lost their hair, and prepping them to go back to school and how to challenge all the teasing and all of the stuff that happens to kids who do go back into school after treatment. And then I worked, I had to do, you're not supposed to do any child removals as a student, but the cases that in my fourth year I landed with the Department of Social Development, and I had to do three removals because my case is just, it was just that. So there was different things that happened to me, but I think the one aspect of my training was when I worked at the farms, and we had to work with the farm workers, with the farmers. And the problems the farmers had with alcohol abuse and all of that on the wine farms, obviously, and how we developed then a community center on the farm. The farmer actually allowed us to build a community center on the farm. And just that community engagement, I think, is what landed for me. This is the space I want to operate in, is community impact, not casework. I loved all the aspects of it, but what really got me going was mobilizing communities.
Sure, there's an interesting dynamic in that, Leona, because I think it's about a season where you allow yourself the space to explore. Now, obviously, this exploration was kind of part of your curriculum, and fortunately, that was the case. But that's not necessarily the case for everybody in their skills journey. But the principle is almost, how do you allow yourself in a season where you're not really sure what the passion is or what the calling or the gifting is, the thing that gets you up in the morning, right? Just go taste some stuff. Just go explore various options and don't put pressure on it, because I think sometimes we put an immense amount of pressure about what is the next step and where am I going and where do I need to be. But when you kind of take a 20-year view on your career instead of a this-year view, I think perhaps the pressure kind of starts to change. And when you discover that passion, it almost radically shifts the trajectory of your life.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's really just having, again, that courage to step out and try different things. Mm. And I think then to have the boldness to say, you know what, I thought this is me. And then having the courage to then say, but no, not. Because if you say yes to something, you actually say no to something else. So it's having that boldness to know what you say yes to and what you say no to. But you can only know that if you go and explore it.
So, Leona, I want to ask you an expanded question on this issue, because I think what I'm hearing you say is just, you know, be brave, go after the things that you're passionate about. But it's almost like you don't get tripped up by a fear of failure, right? But I think a lot of people do sit with that same fear, and I'm assuming you experience that fear, right? When you say, as you've said, when you say yes to something, that means you're saying no to something, and that no can be quite intimidating, especially when the thing you're saying yes to, you know nothing about. You can't predict it. Like the shift from the small community you were in to going to the big city in that mess, and what does that mean for you to say, well, how did you kind of deal with this inherent fear of failure that we all perhaps experience that sometimes brings us into inertia where we're not willing to take that leap of faith?
I think it's also on my journey, I had different mentors, soundboards to guide me through this. And I think Dr. Philip Kutzer was one of those people that was really, he was our fundraising and marketing manager at Mess, and then later on the CEO, which I worked under. And I learned a lot about moving on with him, about we've tried this, it's not working, let's not throw everything away, but let's tweak it so that it's a better fit kind of scenario. So we together build a lot of the developmental programs in Mess because we had to explore, because we had to build from nothing, because it was basically soup kitchens. And I was like, no, we need to have developmental pathways. we can't just hand out. Handout's not going to change people's future and impact their potential. So it was really identifying what is those developmental pathways one needs to build. And when you explore things, there is going to be failure. There is going to be stuff that you try and it's not really fitting. And then not having the courage to say, this is not working. But if we tweak it, or if we bring in another partner, or maybe it's a skill that we're missing internally, how do we source that skill to come in? Because you can't have everything in-house. And that's, again, that ecosystem. Is how do we plug into what's around us? And having that intention to not try and fix everything yourself, but to also look what's available around you to plug that in to make it work.
To me, you sound like an amazing team player because you bring courage to the game. You're like, let's just try this. And if it doesn't work, we'll see if we can make another plan. Because you were also saying you were the first social worker to ever work at Mess. Like you're like this pioneer woman coming into spaces. Is that something that you've always just, this is who Leona is? I've always had this, I'm courageous, I will explore, or did mentors bring this into your space, or is it something that you've always had, this ability?
I think it is something that I was shaped into as a child because of my environment. I had to make stuff work with little. In the community we grew up, there was no fancy stuff in Hibbertsdale. We were a small community town, and you make do with what you have. So that's part of my philosophy, is just do what you can where you are with what you have available to you, and then mobilize that into something that can make impact.
And there's lots of creativity in that. You have to just move with what you have.
I think that's exactly the beauty, right? It's almost that idea of innovation flourishes in constraint. And so what is some of, I mean, you've experienced a lot of constraint in the work that you've done and in your entire career trajectory, but what are some of those moments where the constraint has actually been the womb that has birthed innovation? Don't you want to just chat to some of those things where you guys have innovated out of necessity, but it's actually radically transformed the way that you guys think about what you do and how you do it?
Sure, that's a big one. I think one of the things was when we just wanted to have a little first aid room, because there was so much stab wounds and gunshots and stuff happening in Yellowbrow. And when you were from the homeless community and you came to the provincial hospital, they wouldn't treat you because you didn't have a fixed address. That was now back in the days. So we had to innovate. So we started this little first aid room just so that we could at least, and we had to get first aid training and all of that stuff so that we just knew what we did. But just starting that first aid room was actually the birth of the hospice that happened much later, because the first aid room was just to address immediate need, right? But then HIV came, and we realized, okay, here's a whole new dynamic that we need to deal with. And we started doing community-based care. And then we realized, but we can't get the homeless people that's getting HIV, that's getting terminally ill, into any hospice because nobody wants to take them. And that led to then opening the hospice. And then when we had the hospice, nobody wanted to give them ARVs because they say they're not trustworthy. And then we had to lobby for that. I mean, in our first year, we had 86 deaths in 12 months from 15 beds.
Wow.
It was an insane time in my life. And then we lobbied, we got our own, with Aurum Health and PEPFAR, we actually started our own wellness clinic and started testing the ARVs. And when we had success with that, we could incorporate it back into government. But I think just that choice of a first aid room that eventually then sparked the whole health division of MESS is just interesting how the things sometimes build on top of one another.
Yeah, the innovation that starts from like just solving an immediate need, and you could never predict where that would go. But you do have a story of where this went later on. Don't you want to just tie us into that story?
Yeah, and I just think we God was just so faithful in that, and we got this amazing building where we could start then a homeless hospice. And we could then do the testing of if they can be compliant with ARVs. And I mean, our first year, we, like I said, buried 86 people. And then when we started getting access to ARVs, the next year we had 36, and then it went down within 3 years to below 10.
Wow.
And then when we had enough data, we could then say, can you now integrate into government system? Because our idea was never to build our own empire, but it was to mobilize access to what was needed. And when we could have the data, we could incorporate with the government system.
How did that kind of change over season? So you were speaking in the previous conversation about your seasons at MESS. And this clinic story almost kind of signifies to some extent the seasons in MESS. But what are the kind of primary skills that you think you really discovered during each of those three seasons you mentioned? And how has that translated into practice?
I think I must mention that I did a common purpose course during that time, which plugged me into a whole new community of leaders who think about community work and community solutions from different sectors. And that was an important part because I could then draw from that learnings. It was a whole year program, which was really, I think, a lot of my leadership skills and my soft skills were shaped during that learning journey. And I think if you look at that learning journey, and I think people often think I need to go do a master's or I need to go do a doctor's degree or all of that. But I think just really be intentional with your soft skills, your ability of your resilience. I mean, in that year of being matron at that hospice, I had to have so much resilience because we had so much deaths and we couldn't bury all the people. And it was just a really tough time. But then I think it was critical for me in that time to also find the balance between my family life at that point, where I was married by that time and there's kids involved, and you have to balance that. But then also the problem solving. And I think people so underrate the soft skills. So the conflict resolution in that, the problem solving, the agility and the resilience that goes with all of that. But I think then to find a way to take people with you is the communication. So how do you build a vision and a dream, and how do you not lose people along the way? So it's how do you have that active communication strategy to make sure you don't walk away from the community. In the beginning years, we had to build that relationship and the buy-in, but then later on the risk is you can also move too fast that you lose the community along the way. And I think it's just being intentional with that communication strategy as well.
Leona, the story that you're telling, I think, is so inspiring because lots of our listeners sit and we don't know where we are on our journey. And you might be in the beginning, you might be in the middle, you might be the CEO already. But sometimes we forget that we have to grow like you're saying, you're growing with this organization, you're growing in your skill. And if you're not willing to be courageous in that growth, you'll somewhere, I want to say, fall off the bus. Like you might have to step out, or it might not even be a choice. Mm-hmm. So are there certain points in this 20-year journey with MES where you've been like, you come to this point where you wonder, like, am I now, if I make this, if I'm not growing, I'm going to lose something or someone? Like, what's how do you manage that tension? Did you choose that, or did it happen?
I think, and just a correction, it's 30 years. 30,
sorry,
this year.
I said 20, and I was like, I think it's
no
not
worries.
Enough.
But
30 years is amazing. Like, I want to just say that. It's really,
you know. I think part of my journey was the fact that I joined MES in 94, and in 97, my husband joined MES. And he eventually also worked at MES for 21 years. So we had an interesting journey, because he came in and he was doing the soccer and the sports stuff and the cricket stuff. And then he's in finance, eventually became the finance manager of MES. And at that point, I was the fundraising and marketing manager. So yeah, we were on opposite sides of the table.
You were spending all his money.
Yes.
Well, you were supposed to get all the money.
But I think it's part of what shaped me. He's a very analytical thinker. He thinks through things very carefully, which was needed, because I sometimes would go too fast and then that would slow me down. And I think it's again that issue of, who do you have in your life that can be that soundboard, that mentor, that guide? Because I think we mustn't travel alone. Mm-hmm. God puts people in our life and around us that He wants us to learn from, and He wants us to transfer skills to others again. And it's about, how do we build that next generation of leadership? And it's sharing. It's through sharing.
So I want to zoom in on this issue, because you've been at MES now for 30 years, and you are probably starting to think about succession planning and, like, how do you transfer these skills? But I think it must be incredibly challenging for someone who's been in an organization for 30 years, because you effectively shaped this organization to a large extent. Even though you've been the leader since 2019, I mean, you were pioneering a lot of the dimensions of this organization without being in leadership, just by virtue of being the first social worker in the system. And so there's such a lot actually to transfer. So how are you thinking about succession planning now that you're starting to reflect back and say, well, you know, this is my skills journey, but now I need to start thinking about the people that are going to succeed me and their skills journey, and what it is that they need and what I need to transfer. So I'm assuming this is a new skill that you're kind of starting to develop now, succession planning and leadership development. And what is that like now?
I think it's definitely where my head is. And I must mention Neil from Margon, who wrote his book, has sparked a lot of that in my life. It's just to say, when are we actually standing in the way of the new leadership? And when are we not letting go enough so that others can come in? So I'm kind of in that season right now, Emil, and we made the choice as a board of directors last year to bring in a CFO with a broader scope that could take operational oversight of all the support functions of MES. Because up to then I was doing oversight of programs and everything else. Sure. And I really want to zoom in on the program transfer of skills, because as a social worker first, that is important for me, that the programs are really cemented and sustainable, and that he can now take that side of the business and run with it, so that it frees me up to do the succession planning, the training, bringing the next leadership through. And I think there's some of my team leaders, like Ilse in Cape Town, is so passionate about that leadership, next generation building. So we're very intentional about bringing in young leaders at the moment that can work alongside, that can learn so that we don't have vacuums when we leave. Because the risk is of being there too long is that people say stuff like, you are mess, and that really annoys me because that's not true. It's just I've been there for a while.
But that's actually such a refreshing posture, Leona. Don't you want to just I know it's Neil Hart, right? He wrote the book. I can't remember what it was called. What was the title of that book? It's something like Leaving Well, or but we'll post a link on the channel, because I agree with you. I think there is an important question, but what it highlights for me, Leona, is just even in mastery and even in looking back at a career that has had such a profound impact over the last 30 years, you never really stop learning on this journey. There's always a next.
There's definitely always a next. And I think when COVID started, obviously we all had to learn and we all had to adapt. And it was a big change season for me. And that's where my previous pockets of learning came together, because all of a sudden we had to open this isolation shelter for homeless, and a lot of my hospice days knowledge came into play and reapplied into new context. So sometimes you have a skill but your context differs, and then you can reapply it and adjust it. So it's about that also agility and doing that. But I did a course then last year again with Common Purpose about managing through diversity, and I think that's one thing that I'm still learning is, in our context of South Africa, is how do we really bring diversity and transformation into a Christian space where it makes sense, where we can and really be the best that God intended us to be. And so that course about managing through diversity really made me again aware of the importance of soft skills, and how do we influence through soft skills, and how do we really build on the strengths. And that led us to the Strength Finder, which we then rolled out in our organization to say, you know, sometimes we want people to do stuff that's not their natural strength. It takes them 10 times longer to do it because it's actually not coming naturally. So how do we reset the wheel and really build on our strengths and work from a strength base? And sometimes it's taking the IT guy, who is in our case the big includer and not the IT guy who doesn't talk to people, and use him to bring communities together, people together, because it's his natural skill and it energizes him. So for me, it's about that skills journey of how do I identify my soft skills? How do I utilize that? And how do we bring people from different departments across departments to help other departments? I hope that makes sense. Because sometimes you need that outside view, and maybe your best analytical thinker sits in that department, but you need him now in this department. And I think the time and the era has gone where you work in these boxes. And I think we need to see people for their strengths and pull that in for the benefit of the organization and for their development.
That's beautiful. I think the thing that you're highlighting for me is the complexity that we should be willing to get comfortable with is increasing, because if you put things in nice, neat little silos and you have nice, neat little job descriptions that are standardized, and this is what an IT person looks like and this is what a finance person looks like, it might be easier to manage, but it's not the best way to get the best out of people. And if we really want to engage that, we need to be comfortable with more complexity. But fortunately, you're a master of ecosystems, right? It's the same thing, really. And so it's been such a privilege, Leona, and we look forward to the next episode where we dive into some of the challenges and some of the choices that you've made along this journey. So please stay tuned as we continue a masterclass with Leona Pinar.